coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
If people are living in fear, it is absolutely essential to understand that developing some sense of craving, even if it feels scary, you know, wanting something but being afraid to pursue it, that's the trigger for these molecules to start being released and to move towards it. But we've all sort of been told or conditioned that if we feel fearful, that that's a sign that we should back away or stand still. And biologically, that's just not true.
There's a reason I've talked to so many of our experts on the podcast about magnesium. This super mineral is needed for over 600 enzymatic reactions in your body. In fact, every single cell contains it and needs it to function. Magnesium is essential for stress management and restful sleep because of its influence on our neurotransmitters. It supports insulin sensitivity and fights the risk of type 2 diabetes. And magnesium also reduces C-reactive protein and other markers of inflammation, among so many other crucial functions. I personally started taking magnesium to help with my sleep, especially when I travel, and it's been a game changer. But I don't just take any old magnesium. I take Bio-Optimizer's Magnesium Breakthrough. It contains seven different forms of magnesium, which all have different functions in the body. I haven't found anything else like it on the market. Bio-Optimizer's is great because all their products are soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, non-GMO, free of chemicals and fillers, made with all natural ingredients. Right now, Bio-Optimizer's is offering my community a few special bundles. And for a limited time, Bio-Optimizer's is also giving away free bottles of their best-selling products, P3OM and Mazzymes, with select purchases. Just head over to magbreakthrough.com/Drew with the code Drew10. That's mag, M-A-G, breakthrough, BREAKTHROUGH.com/DHRU with the code Drew10. That's DHRU10. Prescription drugs can have some benefits when they're used in the right way, but it's also important to recognize that they can also deplete key nutrients. Physicians call this MIND, or medication-induced nutrient depletions. And of course, if we're using a prescribed drug to help us with one problem, we don't want to be causing another. Just like many of you, I have people in my life who are on long-term medications like antidepressants, birth control, or statins. Maybe you're currently taking one of these prescriptions yourself. My friends and family who are on long-term prescription meds have found, through working with a practitioner or functional medicine doctor, that in some cases they've become deficient in some critical nutrients. The key is to find out which nutrients can become depleted as a result of long-term medication and replenish these nutrients. A company recently approached me called Even, and they've actually developed an entire whole system and program to help you do just that, replenish what's been lost while using certain medications. Their products are created by physicians, nutritionists, pharmacists, and experts who've identified the exact recipe to rebalance nutrient levels and biochemistry while taking certain meds. Currently, they have formulas for you or anyone you love who's taking antidepressants, statins, or even birth control. Nutrient deficiencies can cause a huge range of symptoms, from fatigue and brain fog to skin problems and pain and so much more. So this is an issue that anyone taking medications should absolutely be thinking about. Right now, Even is offering my community a free consultation and 20% off their first order. Just go to feeleven.com/Drew. That's feel, F-E-E-L, Even, EVEN.com/Drew, DHRU, to check out Even's line of supplements that specifically address medication-induced nutrient depletions. Now let's get back to today's episode. Hi everyone, Drew Perowit here. At one point or another, we've all felt stuck in a rut with feelings of laziness and even fear. During these times, it can be really hard to take a step back and wonder what's happening in the body as opposed to just the mind. But it's the link between the two that can push us through the blockage. Neurotransmitters have some incredible power over how we function. Dopamine is responsible for cravings, motivation, and pursuit. Adrenaline relates to agitation and endurance. Serotonin helps us to be grateful and feel good about what we have in life. And acetylcholine can help us focus. This is just a snapshot of the chemical symphony happening in our bodies at all times. And we can actually leverage these inner reactions to better understand the way we react to the world around us and how to make positive changes. In today's mini episode, I speak with Dr. Andrew Huberman and Dr. Mark McLaughlin about the connection between fear, laziness, and motivation, and tools and strategies for overcoming them. Let's listen in, starting with Dr. Andrew Huberman, a neuroscientist and tenured professor in the Department of Neurobiology and the Stanford University School of Medicine. Work from the Huberman Laboratory has been published in top journals, including Nature, Science, and Cell, and has been featured in Time, BBC, Scientific America, Discover, and other top media outlets. I want to start off with the topic of fear. You know, your lab is known amongst many things. One of your primary areas is studying fear. And there's this topic that comes up for a lot of people. In fact, it was a big question that people had after our part one, which was fantastic. And it was around laziness and motivation. And for somebody who's struggling with laziness and motivation, what is it that they're missing out when it comes to how fear fits into those two as drivers, for good or for worse?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, we don't often think about motivation and fear as in the same breath or the same sentence. We are accustomed to thinking about the fact that when we're afraid of something, you know, we can freeze up. But really, motivation and fear are in the same pathway. And believe it or not, they're in the same chemical pathway. So the only way to talk about motivation is to talk about the molecule dopamine. Dopamine is known for its feel-good properties. We think, oh, you know, a dopamine hit, or, you know, it feels so good, a rush of dopamine. But dopamine's main role in the brain and body is craving, motivation, and pursuit. Okay. And in the absence of dopamine, we don't feel motivated. I'll describe in a moment a classic experiment that illustrates this beautifully. But dopamine's main role is to make us feel motivated and to crave things. Okay. And the interesting thing is that dopamine is the chemical, it's the molecule from which another molecule is made called epinephrine. And epinephrine has another name, which is adrenaline. So to untangle all that, basically craving and desire is the foundation of stress and fear. And people think, well, that how could that possibly be? Well, stress and fear comes from adrenaline. So the way to think about this in a kind of real world context is that when we are afraid of something, we have one of three responses. We can either remain still, we can retreat, or we can move forward. All three of those require some increase in our level of activation. And the molecule adrenaline, also called epinephrine, I probably will use those interchangeably, so it really doesn't matter, adrenaline, epinephrine. That is what's responsible for getting us moving. It's also responsible for our sense of fear and paralysis in fear. So if people are feeling that they're not motivated or as motivated as they would like to be, there's a key step that people need to take, which is to start focusing on the craving aspect and dopamine. Because if you can make enough dopamine, you can motivate, you can actually crave moving through challenge. So we could talk about how to do that. But just to underscore how powerful this relationship is between motivation and dopamine, there was an experiment that was done. It was been done in rats, but it's also essentially been done in humans through naturally occurring things, where basically if you put a rat next to a lever with some juice or even with you know, something really, really good that a rat likes, they will press that lever for that delicious tasting thing. And they get pleasure from it. But if you take a rat and you deplete it of dopamine and you move that lever one rat length away, it won't even move one length of its own body, right? A few inches to hit that lever. And people are the same way. You can still experience pleasure without dopamine, but you won't get up off your couch. You won't challenge yourself to go talk to somebody you want to talk to. You won't apply for a job. You won't pursue the new, fitness protocol, et cetera. So dopamine is about craving of pleasure. It's not pleasure itself. And fear comes from this pathway, right? This pathway of dopamine into epinephrine. And the way to think about fear is it's just one other dimension of motivation. And we can talk more about that. But if people are living in fear, it is absolutely essential to understand that developing some sense of craving, even if it feels scary, you know, wanting something but being afraid to pursue it, that's the trigger for these molecules to start being released and to move towards it. But we've all sort of been told or conditioned that if we feel fearful, that that's a sign that we should back away or stand still. And biologically, that's just not true. So if people are feeling paralyzed in fear, or they are feeling as if they, you know, are unmotivated, it's absolutely essential that they identify some kernel, some little bit of something that draws them forward. And if they feel that agitation, the kind of elevated heart rate, the anxiety, a little bit of sweating, this kind of thing, you know, just imagining that they want that thing, that's great. Those are the molecules that I'm talking about starting to kick into gear. But for some reason, most people start feeling those sensations and they start freezing up or backing away. I hope that was clear.
It was definitely clear. So I guess the question is, do you think that fear is the primary driver for people who are feeling lazy and unmotivated?
I do. I mean, there are two sides to this. I mean, and you see this a lot in the kind of psychological discussion around motivation. It's, you know, it's wonderful to think about moving towards things purely from a place of love and joy, you know, and we feel that and we experience that with a child or with a puppy, or when we hear suddenly, you know, music that we love, we feel that these same molecules are liberated into our body and brain, and we feel that positive motivation. But I think it's, and that's beautiful, and that's a wonderful dimension of life. But I think that it's a mistake to assume that that's how it's going to feel to pursue the everything. And the other side of this is that when there's fear, where you can also be quite motivated. You know, I think we're so averse to the idea of pursuing things out of fear. You know, should someone start running? I'll use myself as an example. I'll embarrass myself by saying, you know, I read recently that the guidelines for physical fitness and cardiovascular health, because I'm 45, I'm like, I should probably start thinking about my heart health. I feel healthy, but it's 150 minutes per week of elevated heart rate, you know, of cardiovascular exercise, which I haven't been doing at all. I do other things, but I just haven't been doing that at all. And I always enjoy it once I'm doing it regularly, but the first couple of weeks are painful. It's a little back thing, and then, you know, all this stuff crops up. But basically I'm doing it out of fear, right? I don't want to die of a heart attack. And if you look at the numbers, if you're not getting 150 minutes a week minimum of cardiovascular exercise, your probability of having a cardiovascular incident goes way up. And you can pretend it's not going to happen because of your genetics, or you can do all sorts of, you know, mental gymnastics. But the reality is that everyone should be getting that minimum, including me. And I wasn't. So fear is the motivator in that case. So fear is a terrific motivator. And I think that we're so afraid of things like adrenal burnout or chronic stress. And those things are problematic for many people. But I think that fear itself is a tremendously powerful lever. And when I say a lever, I mean a chemical lever. This dopamine-epinephrine relationship, the fact that dopamine, this molecule of craving, and epinephrine, this molecule of motivation and agitation, this kind of like stress, the fact that those are such close cousins is never going to be untangled. And so the doing a lot of psychological work to try and just move towards things from a place of love and desire, I think is a terrible mistake. I think that eventually comes, and it's wonderful to have those aspects to one's life. But I think we should all be in more appreciation for the fact that we are wired to be motivated when afraid, and we can leverage that. I'm not talking about living in fear all the time, but I think that we can leverage that. It's what can get us out the door. It's what can move us through tremendously difficult times. So I guess I'm not out to turn fear into something it's not. It doesn't feel good to turn stress and agitation into something it's not. You know, it's called stress and agitation for a reason. But I don't think that it's poison. I think it's the way I like to think about it. Again, I'm calling it a lever because, you know, a lever, you can really move things forward. And then once things are going forward, it's a whole different business. And we could talk about that as well.
So it sounds like the distinction is kind of undirected fear, which is what a lot of people are going through. Just this undirected fear, their mind meandering, wandering, imagining worst case scenarios, but not really, you know, to compare that to directed fear. Like you're really talking about, you know, directing your fear, channeling it, maybe even, I don't know, visualizing it. Would that be an opportunity? Would that be a practice that somebody could use to actually use their fuel as fear in their life?
Yeah,
that's use it. Their fear as fuel in their life?
Yeah, I do think fear can be fuel and it's very powerful fuel. I think that I like the idea actually of using it as a visualization. I think that if you look at the trauma literature, one of the things that we know is that trauma has many different aspects to it, but one of the hallmarks of trauma is two things really. One is a confusion about who's responsible. This is often the case. The brain somehow gets confused about who is responsible for something terrible. Even though we know rationally that wasn't my fault, we still, it's like almost like the nervous system is trying to resolve something. And we get this kind of reverberation of all the terrible feelings. And the other thing that's been shown time and time again is that people really need to not hide from that experience. They need to be able to confront the memory of the experience or the person of the experience, you know, or whatever it was. And of course that should be done in a clinical setting if it's something very severe. But, you know, we've all probably, or at least in California, we've heard of, you know, there's like love and kindness meditation where people will do a meditation specifically aimed towards cultivating a sense of gratitude, which is a beautiful and wonderful practice. It's actually associated with the liberation of a different molecule, serotonin, which is makes us feel good about what we have. Serotonin is sort of the molecule satiety of feeling like we have enough in our immediate experience. Dopamine and adrenaline are really about moving forward or away from things. It's about not feeling comfortable where you're at, either because you're craving or because you're afraid, right? So these molecules are interesting because they really do kind of separate themselves into different psychologies, if you will. So I could imagine taking on a practice where one sits down and focuses their mind on something that they want. So craving, this is not very Zen sounding, right? You're supposed to be separate from desires, but really focusing on something that you very much want or that you very much fear, but is in line with something that is probably good for you. And I imagine that meditation or focus or visualization would liberate these molecules. You know, the brain, visualization is powerful and the brain will make efforts to take a visualization and start creating the chemicals inside that mimic the real experience. And so that's why the kind of gratitude practices are so powerful. That's why focusing on something that we really want, it feels exciting. That excitement is the liberation of these molecules trying. I mean, these cells, they don't have their own mind, but it's a biological strategy to get you to move, to literally to get you out of your chair and move. And I think that it brings up a larger theme, which is that, you know, the reason we have a brain is to move this thing that we call a body, right? Animals that like us, we are animals that can move in lots of different ways, run, jump, swim, push-ups, dance. I mean, the variety of movements that we can do is one of the reasons we have such a big brain. And these molecules, they sound kind of complicated, but they're actually really pretty simple. Dopamine is about craving, motivation, and pursuit. Epinephrine is really about agitation and endurance to get you to persist. Serotonin is really about feeling good about what you have. You know, we hear so much about oxytocin and you know that but oxytocin and serotonin they work together. They collaborate to make you feel good when you hold your child or when you feel like maybe if you've ever had this experience of being at with a group of friends or a party and you look around and you're like, I'm so blessed. You know, I'm so lucky to have these people, right? Or to have this roof over my head. Those are molecular events. And then there's a fourth neuromodulator, which is acetylcholine, which is really about focus. But I would say all of these molecules are applicable. They can be plugged into a visualization practice. This is something that could be done for, you know, 5 minutes a day of just turning off or flipping over the phone and thinking about something in a very directed way and just watching how that makes you feel. If it makes you feel agitated, if it makes you feel good, if it makes you feel a sense of desire, those actually would be powerful practices because it would give you a window into what's happening neurochemically. And most people get this backwards. They sit around and they go, I don't have enough dopamine. Like, what do I need to increase my dopamine? I get this all the time. What should I take to increase my dopamine? And there are things you can take, supplements you can take to increase dopamine. And if you do that, you will feel a lift. This is true, right? There are antidepressants and other molecules you can take to increase your serotonin. Some people just take serotonin. You can now go, at least in the United States, it's legal to go buy the precursor to serotonin. You can do that. And you will feel better about what you have temporarily. But I'm always a fan, unless there's a real clinical need, of looking at behavioral and mental tools first, then looking at the power of supplementation and nutrition, which are real and can be leveraged. And then if there's a clinical need towards prescription drugs, for which certain people, they can be of real benefit. But I love the idea of a fear meditation. Yeah.
Well, it's pretty common in the Buddhist tradition, you know, they'll have like meditate on your death. Or in the Stoic tradition, they'll have, you know, imagine the worst case scenario and really visualize
that.
It through.
I guess I've only heard the California version.
Yeah, you've only
which
heard
which is the go California to Esalen version. And just like and really enjoy the bliss of life, which is a great practice. But I like I think it's important. I think what you're saying is important for people to understand that there's a lot of dimensionality to meditation. It's not just about being relaxed and calm and in gratitude. It's about confronting your inner real estate. And that's really cool.
Fear is not a pleasant feeling. We all know that. Most of us will avoid it at all costs. And often the buildup to a situation we might perceive as fearful is worse than the actual outcome itself. I've been there. I know you have too. My next guest, Dr. Mark McLaughlin, is a practicing board certified neurosurgeon, a national media commentator, thought leader in performance enhancement, and the author of Cognitive Dominance, A Brain Surgeon's Quest to Outthink Fear. Dr. McLaughlin breaks down the fear freakout, how to map out your fear, and the power of taking small actions to overcome fear. Let's listen in. And a few weeks ago, I had shared a quote on my Instagram and social media from Stephen Pressfield on the topic of fear. And I want to share that quote and, you know, follow up with a question with you on it. So the question that was there, and this is from a book, I believe, Turning Pro, that Stephen Pressfield wrote. He says, the amateur believes he must first overcome his fear. Then he can do all his work. The professional knows that fear can never be overcome. He knows that there's no such thing as a fearless warrior or a dread-free artist. So much of what I love about these principles of never worry about a patient alone and some of the other ones you mentioned is that sometimes there's still this misconception in society that we have to get over our fear and that there's some individuals that live in a fearless world, right? That there's people that are out there that just don't experience fear at all. In your deep dive into fear and unpacking it, what have you known and what have you learned about that statement about it being, you know, true or not true?
Yeah, I think fearless people are dangerous. I mean, imagine the things we would do if we didn't have fear. It is an incredibly helpful emotion for us to have. We need to have it. It's universal, and any person who cares about things is going to have fear. It's interesting. My partner was just reading one of my partners at Princeton Brain Spine, Matt Tormenti, was reading a book by Tom Starzl, who's really the world's greatest transplant surgeon at the University of Pittsburgh, and he built the World Center for that. And Starzl said that even before every surgery, he was so fearful that he could barely talk to people before the surgery because all he was thinking about is every single step along the way, what he needed to do. He needed to review his old notes and make sure that nothing was missed. And here's the world's greatest transplant surgeon saying the same thing. I was afraid and barely functional until I got to the OR because of what I was thinking about. We need to think about it in that way. Now, it needs to be modulated. It needs to be thought about, and we need to use that. You know, the amygdala is what I call the deployment software. That's when you're looking around, you're thinking about everything, you're looking for, you know, furtive movements, and that's the kind of, you know, military software that we have installed that we need to have for protective mechanisms when we're walking down the street at night and a stranger starts following us, right? That's important. That's the gift of fear that, you know, that has been well described. But we also need that neocortex to really unpack it in environments where we know we're safe, but we're experiencing the same primitive emotion. It's universal. Everybody has it, but we can outthink it. We can outthink it.
And I think that's the power in the book that I, you know, that I feel that you've written with Cognitive Dominance, is that it's how to outthink it the same way that we would train for anything. If we would train for a marathon, there's going to be techniques. There's things that we're going to bring in. We're not just going to get up one day and just start running for a marathon. We're probably going to get injured that way, or we're going to get exhausted and we're going to give up. But we forget that so often in life when it comes to things like having a difficult conversation with someone, when it comes to the fear that people have of presenting a presentation at work. You know, these fears are real and our body experiences them as real, but we can also train and think through them. So on that topic of thinking and preparing for them, I'd love to talk about, I believe it was the five P's or the four P's that you have inside the book and its relationship and where it fits in this framework that you've developed.
Sure. The way I deal with it is with routines. So if you develop routines and you make them sort of automatic, you're going to set your body and your mind in motion. And, you know, I love Tim McGraw just had a great book called Grit and Grace. And I don't know if he coined the term, but it is definitely the fact that your motion determines your emotion. Your motion determines your emotion. So for my P's, whenever I'm doing any surgery, I pause. I think about exactly who that patient is and why they came to me, whether they've been having trouble picking up their grandchild, or they're dragging their foot when they go for a walk and they realize that they're having progressive weakness in their leg. Once I think about the patient, I think about the procedure step by step, exactly what I'm going to do. I go through it in my mind. Then I put out a positive thought. You know, this is your place and time to do this. You're trained to do this. This is a privilege. Be thankful for where you are and that you can help this person and what you do. And then lastly, I say a prayer. And a prayer for me is something that's always changing me. It's always making me stronger. And I believe it makes me a better surgeon. So the five P's are something that I do every time. And, you know, when I'm doing that positive thought, I'm always thinking about the why. Why am I doing medicine? Why am I performing, you know, surgery? I'm doing this because I want to help people. I want to serve people, you know, and that'd be another thing I would tell my younger self is the Nietzsche quote, which is anyone can endure a what as long as you have a why. Your why, Mark, is being a doctor and serving this young boy in whatever way he needs.
So a couple technical questions on just that system. For the positive thought and prayer for yourself personally, are those things that you say out loud? Do you write them down, or do you just simply think them to yourself?
I think them almost always. I don't usually, won't really say that aloud.
And is there any challenge to saying it out loud if somebody was applying it to what they were doing themselves, or do you do it more out of state that you're just around other people in the operating room and so it's maybe best suited for you to think it internally rather than saying it out loud where other people could hear you?
I know some great surgeons who say prayers aloud before they do surgery. Dr. Beth Dupree, she's a world-renowned breast surgeon out in Sedona. And so whatever works for you. I think that just for me, it's always been kind of more of a private internal space. There's a lot of things going on in the operating room. There's a lot of you know, noises. And so I try and just calm it down and really get down to the meat of why I'm here. Why is this person here? How can I get them back to picking their grandchild up or going for a walk with their wife? That's what I want to do. And then move on to the plan, positive thought, and the prayer.
When we go from something like surgery and we switch over to something that you've also done, which is writing a book. How would you think about, or how did you think about the five P's in the context of your routine and rituals through the writing process, which can bring up a lot of fears and insecurities?
Well, again, that goes back to Steve Pressfield's War of Art. You know, I mean, he really talks about how, you know, if you want your muse to come to you, if you want the spirit that guides your creative light to arrive, you got to show up every single day for it and be regular about it. And so that was an important part of, for me, was I really focused on every day. I got up at 5. I wrote from sort of 5:30 to 7 and was very diligent about it for really about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, anybody who's written a book knows, you know, you've written it 100 times and you excise so many different comments that, and versions. So it was a long process, but it was truly the dedication. And that was something that wrestling helped me too, the determination to actually get it done. So that was huge. I had a huge, coach in my camp with Sean Coyne, who was really helped me get along. And so I had a lot of help along the way. It was not something I did on my own.
There's so many, again, of those lessons that you took from surgery that we can apply into our world. And I want to bring out a quote that I pulled from your book that I just thought was fantastic for this next question that we're about to set up. And the quote says, "The most important bite is the one you are about to take." Unpack that quote, what it means, and how it relates to the world of fear.
Sure. So when we're doing spine surgery, we use an instrument called a Carison Rondeur, and it sort of looks like a little, it looks almost like a handgun. It has two bars to it that with a spring on it, so you squeeze it almost like a trigger, but you're using your hand. And then it has a long neck that almost kind of looks like a Tyrannosaurus Rex with a mouth that closes. And that mouth is very sharp. It has sharp edges to it. And you use it to shave off bone spurs that develop over time as people age. What happens is bone spurs will develop and they'll pinch nerves. So a lot of my time in spine surgery is to shaving off these bone spurs. And, you know, these are 2 and 3 millimeter and sometimes 1 millimeter bites that I'm taking. Each one of those little bites, when I squeeze it, I'm within 1 millimeter of a person's nerve that's going to their leg, going to their foot, lifting the nerve that lifts their foot up when they walk or pushes it down. So what I say is that every single one of those bites is critical. And if I turn the mouth of that instrument 1 or 2 millimeters to the left too much or to the right too much or a millimeter deep, and I grab the nerve root, I can change somebody's life forever. So you need to focus on every single time you close that. You need to know exactly what's in the mouth of that instrument. Dr. Ginetta, one of my mentors, always told me, never cut what you can't see. Never cut what you can't see. Never close the mouth of that instrument unless you see everything. And when you're doing an operation, sometimes I'll pull that trigger 500, 600 times in one operation over the course of 2 or 3 or 4 hours. And, you know, it's easy for you to let your mind wander when you're doing that. It can get repetitive. Repetitive activities, our brain likes to kind of go on autopilot. You can't go on autopilot when you're closing a Carison Rondeur on somebody's around somebody's nerve root. You need to focus on every single bite. So I don't like any chit-chat in my operating room. I don't like people talking about things, you know, other than exactly what we're doing at that time. And what I tell people is, hey, I'm working on the next bite. That's the next bite. That's the most important bite, not the bite before, not the bite later, but the bite I'm about to take is the most important bite. And so it's a concentration technique. It's almost meditative to really focus on that. And it brings me to the Rudyard Kipling quote. If you can treat with, meet triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. You can't be thinking about how great this patient's going to be after surgery while you're taking the bite. And you can't be worried about pulling the nerve root up. You have to just be focused on closing the mouth of that rondeur or on the bone spur and not on the nerve every single time. So thinking about how well somebody's going to do is triumph, or thinking about how bad you could injure somebody is disaster. You can't, they're imposters. they don't live in the present. You have to be in the present moment when you close that ranjur.
Yeah, it's such a powerful phrase and really a lesson that comes in, because so many times when we see that either fear or distraction comes in, it's something that we're caught up in the past, or it's some projection of the future. We're not here in this moment where we're just taking it one step at a time. If somebody has a fear of public speaking, or feel like they gave a talk one time and it didn't go right, even if it's to a small audience, and then they're in that room and they're about to do this thing that they prepared for, that they practiced on. But if the mind goes towards the past, or if it starts projecting the future, that's often when I can see that somebody's lost their train of thought or gets distracted and isn't here just focused on the next most important thing that they have. That's the matter at hand in this moment.
Exactly.
There's another important lesson that I want to pick out of the book. And, you know, I want to start off first by talking about the fight or flight system and its connection to the brain. We've done many episodes where different people have talked about fight or flight in terms of stress, in terms of health conditions that can happen inside of the body, in terms of trauma that's there, you know. And we've also talked about fight, flight, or freeze, right? There's also freeze as a natural response. The idea of basically evolutionary playing dead, you know, a bear comes to attack you, can't fight, you can't flight. Sometimes animals play dead, right? And that's one way that maybe the bear or the tiger or whatever might potentially leave them alone. In the book, you talk about one of the ways to break through this response system that's baked into our brain and our amygdala is the idea of taking tiny actions in the right direction, taking tiny actions consistently in the right direction towards where we want to go. What's the power of tiny actions when it comes to fear and big fears that we're facing in our life?
Well, it's tiny actions in the direction that we subjectively believe is who we are. So that's the key to it, especially when you're in this all is lost quadrant. Let's say you get something, all is lost is when you do everything right and something terrible still happens. So it's like the Anthony experience, you know? It's when you do everything right and still it doesn't come out good. And what do you got to do in that situation? You got to say, like, what do I value most deeply? And what's the one thing I can do to get a little bit closer to that? That's spending time with a loved one, most likely. Telling somebody you love them. Making somebody's pain a little bit easier. Doing a little task that can just help them in some small way. Whatever it is, that's gonna give you a jolt of serotonin, which is a feel-good chemical. And it's also going to decrease your amygdala's signaling of fear. So that's the first step in getting yourself out of a hole, whatever it is.
We all have stories that we create fearful thoughts out of, usually based on projections from the past or worries about the future. But if we address the root cause of fear, just like in functional medicine, we can have some profound breakthroughs that allow us to take on new challenges with a more positive mindset. Mapping out our fears and sitting in the present moment can help us make that shift. Thanks for tuning in to this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowicz Podcast. If you enjoyed it, do me a favor. Send this to a friend who's struggling a little bit with fear. And maybe this podcast could change how they see it and how they approach fear in their own life. Appreciate you tuning in. I'll see you next week.